This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Multiple sclerosis. What is it? You may have heard that it strikes women more often than men, that it affects the nervous system, and it often starts in early adulthood. But beyond that, what do we know about MS now that was not understood even a few years ago? How does it affect those who have it? Why is it so debilitating for some, and for others, not so much? And perhaps most of all, what are the hopes for a cure? With us today, three guests concerned with all these questions. One, a medical doctor who both treats and studies the disease. Another who advocates for better understanding and treatment. And a third who's been living with MS for more than 20 years. Got questions of your own about multiple sclerosis? A story about dealing with the disorder? We'll be looking to add your voice to the conversation, too, right after the news. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. Multiple sclerosis is our focus this hour. Does someone you know, a friend or family member, or even you yourself have experience with this disease? Call us at 888-WMRA-TALK. Do you have questions or theories about causation, diagnosis, the best forms of treatment? We want to hear your voice at 888-967-2825. We have three guests with us to help. Dr. Myla Goldman is a neurologist who heads up a multiple sclerosis clinic at the University of Virginia. Carrie Dahlquist is a staff member at the Blue Ridge chapter of the National MS Society. And Carol Schickman, who herself was diagnosed with MS almost 20 years ago, has for the past several years led a support group for people known as MS survivors, as well as their family members, who live in the Harrisonburg-Rockingham region. Thank you all for making time for us.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you, Tom.
Well, Carrie, let me start with you. Since part of your job in recent years has been communicating with the general public about this disease, trying to promote understanding, what do you think people most need to know about multiple sclerosis?
I would say, first off, there's a lot of misunderstanding about what MS is, a lot of confusion. So I think it would be really good to hear kind of what someone who has MS, Carol, kind of get her perspective on what she would like people to know, kind of her thoughts on that.
Carrie, that's a very nice thing to say. And I said it before, but the wheelchair does not define me, and I am not defined by the wheelchair. Unfortunately, some people see me first, and some people see the wheelchair first. And so I guess I want to say, give me a chance, because I would do that if I saw somebody who was disabled, just to determine where they are.
That's a really interesting perspective that I wouldn't have necessarily brought to the conversation. Dr. Goldman, what's the medical perspective on that? What do you think is the most important thing that we would want to share with people?
I think that I would say, one, that it's common, that multiple sclerosis is common, that it's the leading cause of non-traumatic disability in young people, and that it's lifelong. I think that it's also important to recognize that there are visible and invisible aspects to the disease that somebody is living with. And Carol talked very clearly about a visible aspect, you know, being in a wheelchair. But there may be other things or other symptoms that people live with that are invisible but still important to them in their life. And then finally, I would say that from a research treatment standpoint, it's a very important and exciting time for getting drugs to market and available for individuals living with MS. And we've just had several drugs approved in the last couple of years, and there are three drugs now pending FDA review. So it is a very dynamic time for the treatment options available in managing this disease.
Dr. Myla Goldman, everything that I've heard from the three of you so far is fascinating. I would suspect, however, that there are some people in the audience who are asking themselves, what is MS? Can you answer that version of this question?
I can from a scientific standpoint, and perhaps Carol could could comment on from a more personal experience standpoint. But multiple sclerosis is an autoimmune disease. So it's a disease where the immune system gets confused. And instead of attacking viruses or outside things that infect us, it turns on the body itself. Every organ of the body is vulnerable to autoimmune disease. So rheumatoid arthritis is autoimmune disease of the joints. In multiple sclerosis, it's an autoimmune problem of the central nervous system, which is the optic nerve, the visual pathway, the brain itself, and the spinal cord. And so in a situation like multiple sclerosis, the immune system gets confused and it goes into the brain where it's not supposed to be, and causes inflammation and results in symptoms that patients then experience, and that's the expression of their disability.
So it is a neurological disorder.
Mm-hmm, yes, it's a disorder of the central nervous system, neurologic.
And if you take an MRI of a person's brain and they have multiple sclerosis, what will you see that would not otherwise be there?
We use MRI very, very commonly to make the diagnosis and also follow patients over time. So it's a really important tool. And what we're looking for are essentially white spots. If you put an MRI up and you looked at it in the light, an untrained individual could tell the difference between a normal MRI and an MRI of an individual with MS. So the spots would be readily apparent. And then it has more to do with the location and the nature and different characteristics of the spots that help us determine whether they're related to multiple sclerosis or not, and whether they're changing and what it means for the individual patient.
Would it help us to understand what the term multiple sclerosis means? Why is the disease called that?
The disease is called that basically from a pathologic description dating back many, many, many years ago. But it just is multiple scars. So sclerosis are areas of scarring that are the footprints of this inflammation having been present. And the characteristic of the disease is that patients have episodes repeatedly over time, most often. And so the description is multiple scars or multiple sclerosis, multiple footprints of inflammation. And that's the inherent nature of the disease and part of our diagnostic criteria, part of the criteria for making the diagnosis.
Medical Dr. Myla Goldman, MS Society staffer Carrie Dahlquist, and multiple sclerosis survivor Carol Schickman are our guests. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. If you have a question or comment, we'd love to hear from you at 888-WMRA-TALK, or you can communicate to us through a post on Facebook where we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. And the first one on Facebook is coming from Sarah, who says, how does someone know if they have MS? I have a friend who has long been troubled by periodic tingling in her limbs and sometimes shooting pains in one arm. She says it's no big deal, so she's not gone to a doctor to get it checked out. Should she? Does she need to go to a specialist? What kinds of tests would they do? This sounds like a question for a medical doctor.
I think without speaking specifically to this individual, I would say in general terms, as I mentioned in the opening, you know, there are treatments available for MS, and we think that those treatments do impact the course over time in an individual's prognosis. So it is really important to make a diagnosis and get on treatment. So I would encourage any individual who's having medical issues to seek medical attention. I'm biased. I'm a doctor. But in terms of what is the disease, the characteristic presentation are onset of neurologic symptoms that a person experiences, and then sometimes over time those symptoms will go away, and the person may do well for a period of time and then have another episode where symptoms come back. But in subsequent episodes, the symptoms may be different than the first time, and we call that relapsing, remitting, onset of symptoms and remission of symptoms. And the typical characteristic of these symptoms is what I refer to as crescendo, decrescendo, sort of thinking about a musical analogy where the symptoms progress over days to weeks. Maybe they stabilize for a period of time, and then they would resolve over weeks with or without treatment. And that's the majority of patients who present with multiple sclerosis tell a story like that.
Carrie, I wonder if this question from Sarah hints towards something that in your work with the Multiple Sclerosis Society is what you're trying to overcome. Is it people being hesitant to pursue whether or not they may have the disease? Either they think the testing is going to be gruesome or the knowledge that they get that diagnosis is going to be devastating. What is it in the work that you're doing that you're trying to tell people about MS?
We want people to know that as many unanswered questions as there are about MS, there are lots of questions that we can answer. Of course, getting a diagnosis early, as Dr. Goldman mentioned, is so important and so critical. Many people, once they have been officially diagnosed, realize that they have had these symptoms many, many years prior and had not sought any type of medical treatment or attention for that. We really want to reduce the kind of cloud around what MS is and give people just the knowledge to make appropriate decisions about their care, understanding what would be coming forward, the treatment possibilities, the different drug therapies, rehabilitation services and programs available, and understanding that because of the nature of MS, everyone is affected differently, and what you see in one person's course of the disease is not the way it is in everyone's.
Carol Schickman, what Carrie was just saying, if I understand some of your story, that applies to you, that it was, I think you told me, you're not sure, but you think it was a little bit less than 20 years ago that you finally got a diagnosis that you had multiple sclerosis. But looking back, once you got that diagnosis, you felt that you'd had the disease for many years prior because of the kind of symptoms?
Yes, Tom. I had symptoms for a very long time.
What kind of symptoms?
Numbness in the extremities and tingling. And since it did not impair any other function, I just went on and did not seek medical treatment. Unfortunately, not until I was unable to walk was the diagnosis confirmed. And that was the second episode that I had, and that was unmistakable. So when they put the pieces together of the puzzle, it all added up to MS.
How did you react when they gave you that diagnosis?
That's a very good question, Tom, because a lot of people will say, I was so relieved that this all has a name. It has not a cause, but it has a name. And so I was happy to have a means to deal with the disease. And that was helpful to my medical, for doctors. It was helpful to them to know what it was that I had and what we were treating.
So this is in the early to mid-1990s when you got this diagnosis.
Yes, it was.
I would imagine that, although there's still no cure, that over the past 20 years, there have been improvements in treatments. And obviously, we can ask Dr. Goldman about that in a moment. But in terms of what has changed for you, has there been changes in the types of drugs or approaches that you've been using to kind of keep the disease at bay?
Tom, I'm afraid to tell you no. There are medications available. I did try some, but they did not affect the outcome. They did not change anything.
So you didn't see any improvement as a result. And again, this is something that we'll ask Dr. Goldman when we get back from the break. There are some concerns about side effects, and we'll ask you about your experience with that as well. And remind anybody listening, if you have experience with MS, yourself, someone in your family, someone you know, it would help a great deal if we could hear your perspective. And, of course, we'll take your questions as well at 888-WMRA-TALK. Carol Schickman, an MS patient herself, leads a support group for people with multiple sclerosis that operates in the Harrisonburg-Rockingham region. Carrie Dahlquist is a staff member with the Blue Ridge chapter of the National MS Society, and Myla Goldman is director of the University of Virginia's Multiple Sclerosis Clinic. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Carol, I got the impression that you had questions you wanted to ask Dr. Goldman.
Yes.
And we should mention for our audience's purposes that actually Dr. Goldman is speaking to us from a different studio. She's at a studio in Charlottesville, so we can't see her. And Carol, I don't think you and Myla have ever met before.
I did see Dr. Goldman at an awards banquet that I went to in Charlottesville.
So now you get to talk to her one-on-one.
Yes, a plus for me. Dr. Goldman, I'm most interested in the medications you mentioned. Newer, what are they doing? Tell me about them.
So there are seven sort of commonly used medications for the treatment of multiple sclerosis. And, you know, the first was approved in the early 1990s. Many patients were on a lottery system in order to get access to that first interferon beta. And then over the next, 10 years or so, a series of medications came out, all injectable. And then in 2006, we had the approval of a monthly infusion therapy, natalizumab. And most recently, in the last 2 years, the oral therapy, fingolimod, for the treatment of MS. And all of these medications basically work in different ways to modulate or change the immune system's behavior with hopes that in doing so, they can prevent the immune system from going in and misbehaving in the brain and spinal cord like we talked about in the beginning. The key limitation of these medications is that they don't fix problems you already have. They appear to only work to prevent new problems from occurring. And so that's why starting treatment early on is, we think, more impactful than starting it later in the course. There are limitations to these medications. Not every medicine works for every person. There are some medicines, for reasons that we don't understand, seem to work better in one individual and others that work better in another individual. And of course, there are side effects and tolerance issues. And then with some of the newer medications, there have been safety concerns as well. So we have to be very careful about balancing the risk-benefit for any individual patient when we move between these medications. And then
Triple
I would
eight.
Just add...
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I would just add, finally, that there are three oral therapies that are currently under FDA review, which is really significant for individuals living with MS who have been giving themselves daily or weekly or every other day injections for over a decade.
888-967-2825, our phone number. We're getting some calls now, but we still have at least one line open. If you want to join this conversation with medical doctor Myla Goldman, MS Society staffer Carrie Dahlquist. It's Carol sitting next to her, Carol Schickman, who has multiple sclerosis herself and leads a support group in the Harrisonburg area. First call coming in from Bridgewater. Barbara, thank you for joining us. Your question or comment, please.
Yes, I was telling the young man that I spoke with, one of the concerns that I have, and I have found that many have, that I have worked with over the past at least 15 years, in working with support groups, is that a lot of people believe that the majority of people with MS will be in a wheelchair, and they didn't want to come to the support groups because they were afraid to see people in a wheelchair. And we had to work certainly around that idea, because from what I have read, it is not the majority who would ultimately be in a wheelchair. A portion, yes, and it's a very bad thing. I am not in a wheelchair. People think this is strange for me to say, but I think I've been very fortunate. If I have to have MS, I am physically able still to move around. My primary problems have to do with the brain, memory, thinking, rationalizing. I was a teacher, and of course, that is gone now. So I think that's very important to
Barbara,
know. I'm sorry,
Barbara. This is Dr. Goldman. I just wanted to add in there. I think you've identified an important issue that I'm wondering if Carol can comment on. In her experience, I've had that experience in my clinical practice where patients have concerns about coming to the office to see me because they don't want to see other individuals with MS who may be affected, you know, at different levels or in different ways. Carol, what's been your experience with your support group and how do you navigate those kinds of issues for people?
Dr. Goldman, thank you for asking me this question. We take anyone who wants to come to our group. We are very positive. We laugh a lot. My primary job is I'm in charge of getting the pizza, and that's what matters to me the most. But we allow for anyone to say anything or ask anything or do anything.
In terms of this idea that people see you in a wheelchair, Carol, and say, I don't want to even think about the possibility that my MS could lead me to be where Carol is.
Tom, I hate to sound contrite, but that is not my problem. I present myself as well as I can, and I can't determine how other people will feel about me or themselves as a result of speaking to me.
But do you have any sense that people hesitate to get more involved with support groups, as Barbara was saying, because they don't want to see what happens to some people?
Yes, Tom, that's very true. And there are many members of the community that have MS that do not choose to come out and speak about it, do not choose to join in the support group just to get together with other people who understand their position. So if they elect not to interact with other people with MS, that's a choice they have made. And for whatever reason, that's the way they're going to go.
This is Carrie. I'd like to jump in here really quickly and say that for those people who aren't engaged with others and communicating with others who have MS, they are missing a little bit. They're actually missing a lot because to sit here and talk with Carol and hear her perspective, which is very much a positive, I'm taking charge of this and I'm going to move forward with my life, that's very empowering. And, you know, I can certainly understand it can be a little daunting for someone who has been diagnosed to think this is what, you know, is this where I'm going to end up? But, you know, there are always positives to that. And the purpose of our social interacting programs with the MS Society is to get people to talk about this and open up and to have them feel empowered in their own medical care, in their life, and to know that if they do end up using assistive devices, it's not, there's nothing wrong with that. It's just going to make it easier for them to do some things. And everyone with MS, just like anyone else, has different abilities. So it's finding what works best for you.
Barbara, we knew into this subject that we were going to end up risking getting into some sensitive areas. And I wondered if people would feel comfortable doing that. Of course, in terms of service to the audience, getting to the heart of the matter is always best, and you've helped us with a big aspect of that.
Can I really jump in?
Go ahead,
yeah,
Dr. Goldman.
And thank you. In listening to the conversation, I think we're also missing a really important barrier that also exists on the flip side, which is somebody who maybe is walking but is affected by more invisible symptoms. You know, you look so good or you look too good to have MS. They may not feel comfortable going to a support group because they're not, quote unquote, sick enough. And so there may be a misconception there that they're not welcome because, you know, they're barriers or their limitations with MS may be different or not as tangible. So we have to recognize all the different complexities of the disease itself and also how that affects people's lives and remain open to them. And I think Carol's comment about having a good attitude and having pizza and having the doors open is so important because every person is fighting their own battle.
I want to know what toppings are your favorite, but hopefully we'll have time for that later. Barbara, thank you again. We have another call here from Hillsville. This is Regina. Thank you for being so patient. Your question or comment for our guests, please.
Okay, my question is concerning the medications that are available for the severe fatigue that is involved with MS. I don't have insurance, and I had been doing samples from the doctor's office. They'd been giving me ProVigil, and then they switched it to NuVigil, which now I can't get either one. But anyway, they said, oh, we're going to have a generic out for the ProVigil. So the generic is out. Well, even at that, I talked to my pharmacist, and the cost of ProVigil generic is over $600 for a 30-day supply. Why is this medication so expensive? And, you know, why can't we get, you know, assistance in getting this stuff?
Regina, this is Carrie from the MS Society. I would recommend that you call one of our MS navigators and talk with them about the different drug assistance programs that are available. Many programs are available through the specific drug companies, so that is a good place for you to start.
Okay.
And I can actually share that number with you. To reach an MS navigator, it's 800-344-4867.
Okay.
Regina, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Carol Schickman, an MS patient herself, leads a support group for people with multiple sclerosis in the Harrisonburg-Rockingham region. Carrie Dahlquist, a staff member with the Blue Ridge chapter of the National MS Society, and Dr. Myla Goldman is director of the University of Virginia's Multiple Sclerosis Clinic. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. If you'd like to join the conversation, we've got a phone line open for you at 888-WMRA-TALK. Here on our Facebook page, we seem to be getting questions mostly that look like they're directed toward you, Dr. Goldman. So let's jump to this one from Jessica, who says, I read that Ann Romney has been using acupuncture to treat her MS. Does Dr. Goldman support that kind of alternative approach?
I would say, I don't know, I'm not familiar with Ann Romney's use of acupuncture. I think that there are several alternative approaches to health that can be used to complement main pharmacologic treatment. I don't think that acupuncture would be a substitution to a traditional MS medication. I don't think we have evidence to suggest that is effective in changing the course. But I do think that there are lots of therapies and approaches that are very helpful in managing the consequences of the disease. So when you think about treating MS, you have to address the immune system problem, and then you have to address the symptoms that are a consequence of the immune system having gone into the central nervous system, into the brain, and causing a problem. And in my experience, acupuncture has been very helpful for some of my patients who have spasticity or stiffness or limitations in the mobility of a limb as a consequence of MS. And so there may be value there. It is expensive and not often covered by insurance, and so there are in some situations barriers to using that. There's also information and interest in taking herbal supplements in addition to MS medications. And while we're on that topic, I'd like to just offer the resource on the National MS Society website. They have a pamphlet that speaks specifically to the optimal or best herbs to take, and that an individual has to be cautious because they don't want to take a herbal supplement that is going to turn on or rev up or increase the activity of their immune system, because that would be counterproductive to managing their disease. So you have to make sure you're taking the right supplements if you're going to use that in combination with your other therapies.
Carol Schickman, you've had this disease, to your knowledge. You got diagnosed a bit less than 20 years ago. Ann Romney, I think, got diagnosed in 1998, 1999, but it's only been recently, since it became clear her husband was going to be the Republican nominee, that there's been much publicity about the fact that she had MS. From your perspective, having such a high-profile person talk about having this disease, is this a good thing? Is this a big plus?
Yes, Tom, this is a giant plus. I watched Ann Romney, and I can spot things as far as spasms and things, and she seemed to be in great shape. Another person that I keep my eye on is Montel Williams.
Mm-hmm.
And he has some spasms that are visible to a trained eye.
The revelation that Ann Romney has MS has definitely raised awareness. We are starting to hear more and more people come forward that they do have an MS diagnosis. And it certainly generates a lot of conversation and a lot of discussion about that. Just recently, within the last couple of months, Ozzy Osbourne's son announced he had MS, 24, 25 years old. And we know that through our avenues of conversation within the MS Society, we were having a lot more hits on our website, a lot more discussion on through our social media, people wanting to know more, wanting to understand it.
Myla, if you would. One is, if I could ask you a simple question, and then
sure.
You could add what you were going to. The simple question is, how many people have MS in the United States? How frequently does it strike?
So the current estimate is about 400,000. The number that's often used is 1 in 1,000 individuals is affected.
Well, if it's 400,000 in a country of 300 million, it would be a little bit more frequent than 1 out of 1,000.
People say between 300 and 400,000. The increase, there's been a recognized increase in diagnosis, and it's uncertain whether the prevalence, whether we're seeing more MS or we're just recognizing it earlier because of our technology advances.
I haven't driven you too far off track.
I would say 1 in 1,000 is the number you want to take, out to the streets.
Do you remember what you were going to say before
I think it's. I really applaud the courage and what may be difficult for these very visible figures, whether they're political or through entertainment, to come out and talk about having multiple sclerosis. But I would also make a call to all of them to leverage that. And I think that Michael J. Fox, is a really just phenomenal inspiration and example of leveraging in terms of his foundation and the money that he's raised
for Parkinson's
to find a cure for Parkinson's disease, exactly, the disease that he's afflicted with. And so I would just, make a call out if any of them are listening, to really leverage that and increase research dollars and funds available to help people with MS.
Phone number is 888-WMRA-TALK. 888-967-2825. Subject is multiple sclerosis. Dealing with it, diagnosing it, living with it, treating it, and hopes for a cure. If you have questions or comments on any of the above, we've got a couple phone lines open. Betsy in Stephen City, you'll be next when we get back in just about 1 minute. Betsy in Stephen City, thanks for joining us on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment for our guests, please.
Hi, my comment is I am an MS survivor. I'm 52 years old. I've had MS for about 20 years, and I'm currently on Copaxone, which is working well for me. And something that I find is helpful for me, I do work full-time. I don't have any children in the house anymore. I'm a fairly active person. I exercise, and something that helps me less fatigued and stressed is certainly staying organized, writing things down, putting things back in the same place every time I walk in the house, and trying to get as much rest as I can, particularly on weekends. One day is kind of a rest day, one day is a work day. So those are things that help me, and I just thought I would offer that up.
Thank you, Betsy, for sharing that. I'd like to call attention to your comment about exercise.
This is Dr. Goldman.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Tom. Exercise is so important, and, you know, to do any amount of exercise, you know, whether that's just doing arm exercises if you're restricted to a chair, or doing very, you know, floor exercises if you're not able to do a lot of walking, but exercise has been shown time and again to be a really important factor in maintaining health, and good for folks with MS. So you called attention to that routine and creating that familiarity and then having that rest, but your comment about exercise, I think, is also important to recognize.
Yeah, and I used to be a skier and mountain biker and very, very active, and those are things that I certainly had to modify. And
right,
I am on a bike now, and I swim, so, you know, I or a treadmill, you know, as opposed to getting out on the road. So,
well, good,
you know,
for you, Betsy.
The activity and still benefiting from exercise, yeah, has worked well for me.
Betsy, how long ago did you get your diagnosis?
22 years.
And what finally got you to a doctor?
I couldn't hold on to pencil at work. I was klutzy, tripping, had a little optic neuritis, I found out, some double vision weakness. And
so did you go for a significant period of time experiencing symptoms that you chose not to see a doctor about?
No, I just thought I was just getting stressed out at work, primarily, and then finally consulted with my doctor as things started to become more... have a regular pattern of not being myself. And finally,
Betsy, thank you so much for your call. I apologize for interrupting, but we're getting to the point where our cell phone connection to you is dropping in and out, but you certainly have added valuable insight to this conversation. I want to thank you for doing that. Myla Goldman, Dr. Goldman, let me go back to you. What Betsy was saying in terms of having symptoms for some period of time before she got tested for MS, do you find yourself wondering how many people there are out there who are staying away from the doctor who should be getting tested, just like wondering if Betsy might have done it sooner, if her treatment might have helped sooner?
I don't wonder. I mean, I see both sides, both presentations in my practice every day. You know, people who have a symptom and they get in and they get attention early. And then I see people who have symptoms and they don't seek attention for a variety of reasons. You know, the most one of the most unfortunate things about MS is it affects women more often than men, and it affects them typically, you know, in their early adult life, maybe between the ages of 20 and 40. And that's the time in our lives as women that we're busy taking care of everyone else and working, you know, on our careers and our families. And so I think it's common that women maybe are too busy to take care of themselves and pay attention and get in to see a doctor. And sometimes, as I mentioned earlier, the symptoms do improve. So they go away and they think, oh, well, that was weird. And they move on. So I think there's a lot of different reasons why people maybe don't seek care right away.
I think another thing to add to that
is Carrie.
Yes. Thanks, Tom. A lot of people don't want to be public with it. They're concerned about long-term insurance coverage. They're concerned about employability. Those are some other barriers that are in place that keep people from seeking a diagnosis, from seeking treatment, or that keep them from sharing their diagnosis with other people and engaging in some of the programs and services that are available for them, just not wanting to disclose that diagnosis.
And I would say, Carrie, I mean, I think that that's okay sometimes. I mean, I think people have to come to it in their own way and in their own time and in their own fashion. And so some people are going to get up there and be ready to jump in and, you know, start an MS walk team. And some people are not going to be comfortable with that. And I think that it's okay as long as they're being honest with themselves that they need medical attention and they're engaged in a productive therapeutic relationship with their doctor.
Until recently, Carrie Dahlquist spent 4 years working with a Texas-based chapter of the MS Society. Then just a couple of months ago, she moved to Virginia and took a job as manager of mission engagement for the Society's Blue Ridge chapter, serving much of Virginia, West Virginia, and Kentucky. Myla Goldman is a medical doctor, a neurologist, who both treats and researches MS in her role as director of the James Q. Miller Multiple Sclerosis Clinic at the University of Virginia. Former legal secretary Carol Schickman was diagnosed with MS close to 20 years ago. Today, she leads the Harrisonburg-Rockingham Multiple Sclerosis Support Group. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. If you have questions or comments about multiple sclerosis, we've got just a few more minutes to take calls at 888-967-2825. Carol Schickman, I could have sworn a couple of moments there you were going to jump in and then you hesitated. Is there something you'd really like to say?
Well, Tom, I was going to ask Betsy about the effect that Copaxone is having on her, and she really answered that question by herself. And so I would have addressed that. But I guess what matters most to me is my support group. And you mentioned the word empowering. And if I have been able to empower the members of this support group in any way, then I have done my job.
Well, tell us more about the support group. Who comes? What do you guys do in addition to pizza?
The MS Society has a web page. It's called MS Learn Online. And there's always a video about whatever it is that is new and current. And so there's always a video to watch. There's always information to be had. And we share this together in a room. And so we learn and benefit from the MS Learn Online features on the website sponsored by the MS Society.
What did people tell you about what having this disease has done in their lives, how their lives have changed? How has your life changed as a result?
I would say simply wake up and smell the coffee. Just to be aware of things that are going on and people really having more of an awareness of the world and of people and of things, just paying a little bit more attention to everything that's good. There are things that are not so good, but dwelling on the positive is one thing that I have found to be very successful. And I am fortunate that I have a husband who also believes that the positive is the way to go. And I am blessed.
So what are some of those positives?
Positives. I attend many college sporting events. It's a lot of fun where people are rooting for a team, watching football or basketball, college sports. Very entertaining, very engaging, and a lot of fun.
Here on Facebook, this question from Frank, again for you, Dr. Goldman. Is pollution a factor in causation? Are people more likely to get the disease if they were exposed to lead paint as children, or could impurities in drinking water or air pollution play a role?
So the cause for multiple sclerosis is unknown. What we do know is that there are what appear to be individuals who have some genetic susceptibility, so they're vulnerable for some reason based on their DNA, their genetics, and then they interface with some environmental factor. And we don't know what that environmental factor is. Some of the things that were mentioned there have been looked at. Nothing definitive has been found to suggest that drinking water impurities, for example, or lead paint are actually causative for multiple sclerosis. There's been a growing interest and exploration of vitamin D and vitamin D deficiency as being potentially important. And there's been a lot of interest in different viruses and the relationship between getting a viral infection and ultimately or subsequently having multiple sclerosis. But there's been no single virus that's been implicated.
Our next question on Facebook actually is somewhat similar to that last part that you just mentioned, Myla. Mm-hmm. This is Aziz, who notes that the August 18th issue of The Economist magazine has an article about the trillions of bacteria that live in the human body and the part they play in our health. Although many live in harmony with our bodies and some in symbiosis, multiple sclerosis was listed in this particular article among the diseases that these bacteria may play a role in. Can you shed any light on that, Aziz wonders?
I'm actually not familiar with that article. We used to read The Economist, but it's very expensive.
But it's also, you know, some people confuse bacteria and viruses, and so it right. could very well be viruses that
right.
you were just mentioning.
I'm not familiar with the contents of that article. I mean, there is certainly what we call normal flora, which are bacteria that live in our bodies that help protect us and play an important role in our health. And when we disrupt that, we can see problems and infection. There's been interest in whether tolerance or looking at sort of what's happening in the gut immune interface is important. And there's been a lot of press coverage for people eating parasitic worms in Wisconsin. There's a study there in Milwaukee looking at what eating a parasitic worm may do to be protective or helpful for the management or treatment of MS. So I don't know specifically what they're referring to, but there is a lot of potentially a story to be told there. And I think we just need more research.
And you do research. What? Mm-hmm. Tell us some about the kind of research you do.
My research right now is focused on outcome measures. So I'm interested in the tools that we use to determine whether patients are getting better or worse and how we would use them to determine whether treatments are effective or not effective. I'm running a study right now looking at walking measures of walking, and specifically community ambulation, how much people walk in their everyday life, and whether we can use that as an indicator for whether or not they're doing better or worse in regard to their MS. We are recruiting for that study, so you could contact us if you were interested. And so we're looking at early indicators of disease progression and how we might use that to test our drugs more effectively.
It seems to me that one of the things that you said early on, Myla Goldman, was that the drugs that are available today do not reverse anything, that the best that can be hoped for is they kind of hold future deterioration at bay. Is that a fair summation?
Yeah, so all of the drugs that have been tested so far have the primary endpoint has been relapse reduction, so to reduce the number of inflammatory events that an individual experiences on the drug. So that's exactly right.
This is another reason for wanting people to get diagnosed as early as possible. If you
exactly.
can start getting them on these drug regimens, these treatment regimens, before the disease has progressed, you can kind of halt things in their track, or at least significantly slow that progression?
Exactly. So that's why early diagnosis and early treatment is thought to be so important. Because once an individual has had damage in the central nervous system, you know, once they have disability, we don't have a drug to fix that problem, you know, at this point in time. That would obviously and is, you know, a goal to do research to understand how to repair the central nervous system. But all the drugs that we're using now, we think prevent further damage.
Kerry Dahlquist, the Multiple Sclerosis Society, has this program it calls Now, No Opportunity Wasted.
Yes. The Now campaign is to bring attention to our national research program. And like Dr. Goldman mentioned, we are interested in restoring what was lost from the disease. So we want to stop MS in its tracks. We want to restore the function and ability that was lost. And we want to end the disease. We want to do our best to keep anyone from being diagnosed again in the future.
And so this is in part a fundraising campaign, because you're saying more money is needed for more research?
Yes, correct.
Myla Goldman, as a neurologist who both treats people with MS and has been researching this disease for a number of years, those goals that you just heard Kerry enumerate, how realistic do you think they are?
I think that she touches on, and the campaign touches on, all the facets of what it means to cure MS for any individual person. Cure might mean repairing the central nervous system. Cure might mean prevent the disease from occurring in their children or loved ones, and then, you know, to stop the disease in its track might be to cure it at that moment in time. So I think that when people talk about curing MS, there's all these facets to it. I think that we have made tremendous strides in stopping the disease in its tracks, preventing it from getting worse. I think we have a lot of work to do in understanding how to repair the central nervous system. And that's true across all aspects of neurology for a variety of injuries to the central nervous system. And I think we also have an increased and growing understanding about the genetics and how maybe to affect the disease from presenting itself. So I think those are all important goals, and I think that we have made important strides and that success is forthcoming.
Carol Schickman, my first question at the beginning of the hour was to Carrie about what she wanted people to know about MS, and she tossed it to you. Now that we're almost done, we got 10 seconds left to see if you've got anything to add about what you want people to know about multiple sclerosis.
Tom, I would like people to just be educated about the disease and learn what they can, just to know something about something. And that would probably help me more than anything else.
Our guests have been neurologist Myla Goldman, director of the James Q. Miller Multiple Sclerosis Clinic at the University of Virginia, Carol Schickman, leader of the Harrisonburg-Rockingham Multiple Sclerosis Support Group, and Carrie Dahlquist, manager of mission engagement for the Blue Ridge chapter of the National MS Society. Thank you all for making time for us.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Tom.
You can find more information about all of our guests by going to the Virginia Insight webpage at WMRA.org, and you'll find links to contact information there as well. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more insight.